This is a discussion on mercy and justice and the biblical rhythm between the two as two modes of loving our neighbor. My name is Charles Lutz. I work for the American Lutheran Church in the area of church and society. And in a way, this is the first of a series of four that will look at issues of justice and peace in our current scene. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the church in Central America and what we can learn in North America from what's happening in the Central American scene, particularly the role of church in revolution there. And I'm going to be drawing primarily on the experiences of the trip which ALC bishops made last fall, last October, which I had the privilege of being a part of. And I think we'll have at least one of the ALC bishops who was on that trip with us. Cliff Lundy has told me he can be available to participate in that discussion. On Wednesday at this same hour, we'll talk about some of the ethical frameworks for looking at the use of armed force, peace and war, which are around, both the obvious stated ethics of war and peace and some of those that are operative but less obvious, not usually identified as such. And then on Friday, we're going to try to look a little bit at a theology of love for enemy in the U.S.-Soviet Union context. What would that mean for Christians in a superpower today? What I'd like to do in this hour is explore with you the relationship between justification and justice on the one hand, and then as we, in relation to God's treatment of us, and then the relationship for us in dealing with each other in the world between justice and mercy, or justice and grace. Lutherans have for a long time stressed God's grace in justifying us, and in fact that's become almost the central theme of Lutheranism. I think the Lutheran movement has been dominated by that concern, that concept, that understanding of the gospel from the very beginning, from Martin Luther's own experience. That has, at least for many Lutherans in this country, it seems, led to a kind of neglect, benign or otherwise, of the realm of human justice. It's as though we have been so preoccupied with justification that we could not address the issues of human justice or civil righteousness in the terminology of Reformation times. Martin Marty says we can stop worrying any day now about Lutherans trying to work their way to heaven because nobody's trying. That's one message we have caught, and we don't want to deceive God into thinking we're trying to work our way into heaven by doing any works. It reminds me of the story of a dying man that I heard when I was growing up in Iowa, German Lutheranism, and I'm sure it was apocryphal then, but it makes the point. This elderly gentleman reportedly was on his deathbed, and his pastor was there with him ministering to him, and his pastor said, "Well, Joseph, are you sure that you're going to meet your Maker, that you're going to be saved?" And Joseph said, "Yes, of course, Pastor, I'm absolutely certain of that." And the pastor said, "Well, fine, I'm glad to hear that, Joseph. Why are you so sure?" And Joseph's reply was, "Pastor, because I've never done a good work in my life." The same point that I think Martin Marty was trying to make. How then do we put together justification by God and our calling to seek justice in our world? Are those two mutually exclusive, or what, in fact, is the relationship? Is it only accidental that the words justice and being declared just by God, being justified by God for the sake of Christ, and justice in human social order terms are the same word? Well, I think it is more than accidental. They are, of course, the same word, and they have common rootage. How do we stay biblically faithful to both themes, that God is merciful toward us, and the theme that we are called to live in some measure of justice and mercy with one another? How do those two relate in our love of neighbor, in our relationship with one another? Well, first some comments on the justified status and what it says about the energy for a life devoted to justice. Our justified status tells us, first of all, that we don't have to justify ourselves. We don't have to make efforts and worry about becoming justified before God, because that's already taken care of. We are free people. We are free of any need to posture before God or one another. We're free of any need to work our way into God's acceptance, and that frees us for lives of service to those who need us. Since there's nothing we can do to earn God's favor, we have a lot of free time. And that time is free in the Lutheran understanding, ethically, for loving our neighbor. That's what we do with all that time that we now have free, because we don't have to work at justifying ourselves. We are beyond preoccupation with our own security, with ourselves, and we can become preoccupied with others and therefore live on behalf of others. When there's nothing we have to do, what do? Well, we seek out our neighbor in need and love her, love him. Good works are what we do when we don't have to do anything. It's another way of putting it. Good works are what you do when you don't have to do anything. Our baptism is the sign of that freed status. It is our call, our ordination, into a lifelong ministry on behalf of others. The gospel tells us further that we find ourselves precisely, our authentic selves, in that way, by losing ourselves, our concern for self, in the pursuit of justice and mercy for others. By definition, to be justified, to be declared okay by God, is to be engaged in the quest for a more just world, a more just society, a caring and compassionate human order. In that quest, we join with all others, all who seek it, believers and non-believers alike. And in that quest, we don't fuss about whether people who engage in it with us share our faith. That is, we can work with others who do not believe as we believe, as long as the goal is greater justice in the present order. That is not the whole of the biblical message, but it is an important part of it. Some make a distinction between the biblical witness to saving faith and the biblical witness to ordering faith, faith which has to do with the human order here and now, the social order, the economic order, the political order, issues of equity and land use would be part of that concern, not part of the concern for saving faith, if you want to draw that kind of distinction. Now, what about the biblical interplay between mercy and justice? I think for the sake of making the point, I'm going to be drawing this more finely than the Bible does. It tends to be mixed more in the scriptures. But I think there is sufficient and valid basis for making the distinction. The biblical words, both Hebrew and Greek, are different for mercy and justice. Mercy is the English word for the biblical idea of what can't be required. Mercy is what cannot be required. It's an attitude toward the other of compassion, of caring, without regard to merit. Mercy is what you do, how you address yourself or comport yourself toward those who don't deserve mercy. Mercy is something that cannot be demanded, therefore. It describes the way God deals with us, and therefore the way God's people are to deal with others. It is kin to grace, that kind of love which cannot be demanded and is never deserved. Justice, on the other hand, is the biblical term for a set of right relationships, for what is required, what is expected, what can be demanded. It goes more with law than with grace. The prophetic writings of the Bible talk about justice a great deal, economic justice especially. They condemn systems in which the poor are left to suffer, in which people are made poor because of the exploitation of others, or because they have no access to land, or in which people without, in biblical times, visible means of support are abandoned with no sustenance. Widows, orphans, refugees, or aliens, typically. Most people can understand the concept of justice in human terms. It is basically what is fair. We will argue a great deal about what is fair, but the idea of fairness we can understand. And we all want it. We all want fairness for ourselves, even if we aren't always good at dispensing it to others. Mercy, I think, is even harder for us to dispense than justice, and it's also harder to accept. Mercy puts one in a position of need. We don't like to admit that we need merciful treatment from others. We don't like to be on the receiving end of charity. We don't like to admit that we need it from God. And yet, if God treated us according to justice, this is clear biblical teaching, if God treated us according to justice, what we deserve at the hand of God, we would all die. We wouldn't die just eternally, we would die daily, because God's part of God's mercy is to sustain us through the land, through the earth, through the gifts of other people to us who help us to live. God rather treats us in the mode of mercy and then calls it justifying the unrighteous, declaring to be just those who are not, and thereby lets us live. Well, that's mercy, that's grace. Think of the story of the prodigal son, which we all know. Is that a story focusing on justice or on mercy, do you think?
Mercy.
Now, you say that because that's the bottom line of the story. But there is in it a character who demands justice, right?
The older brother.
The older brother wants justice for the younger brother. The elder brother wants the father to treat the younger brother upon his return home after the mode of justice. Give him what's fair, Dad, he asks. The father does not, in fact, treat the younger brother that way. Mercy or grace, receiving what is not deserved, makes other people angry. Grace makes people angry, particularly those who feel they are not on the receiving end of it, or that somebody else is without deserving it. The charge is, typically, it's not fair. And that charge is correct, according to human reasoning. I think some of you will recall the debate about 10 years ago in the United States over amnesty for war resistors during the Vietnam War. And the common resistance to the idea, some people supported it as a way of doing healing in the society and getting the war behind us, but those who opposed it typically said it's not fair. It's not fair to those who went. They didn't want to go either, but they went. They did what there was, what their country, they felt obliged them to do. It certainly wasn't fair to those who went and didn't return because they were killed. And all of that analysis was an accurate one. It wasn't fair. Amnesty, I think, is an interesting concept in the law because in a way it's legal grace. Amnesty is something the law never has to do but may choose to do, not because it's fair to those who receive it, but because of a greater good that it brings to the society. As after the Civil War, there were a number of amnesties declared. And in many cultures, that has been a pattern. You can never require amnesty to be done, but a society may choose to do it for good social reasons. It is legal grace. There are other kinds of legal grace, too, that we may want to talk about later. Now, I'm going to use the board and put down some characteristics, just quick contrasting characteristics of the two modes, that I think will help to show the comparison and the distinction between the two. And under the heading of mercy, I would begin with the word grace. It is likened to grace, which means can't be required. Justice, on the other hand, is akin to law. And that means it can be required. Or the word charity, which means voluntary. Justice, the word compulsory, or involuntary. Apologize for the squeak. Mercy, we might say, in today's U.S. culture, the United Way. Doing public things with voluntary contributions. Whereas on the justice side, we would put the word taxes. Very few pay taxes voluntarily. Some of us do it more or less willingly, but it's always involuntary. Even if we don't want to pay taxes, taxes are a requirement and to be paid. Mercy tends to deal with casualties. Justice tries to get at root causes. Mercy would be more like the immediate needs, and justice would be have more to do with systemic change. Think, for instance, of ministries with refugees. Voluntary, compassionate response to the situation of refugees would probably fall in this column, whereas trying to deal with the what causes refugees at the source in their home countries, or after they arrive in another part of the world as refugees, trying to make them legal, make undocumented persons legal, for instance, from Central America today in our system, that would be a justice issue. And that leads to another contrast. Mercy is more like diaconal ministries, ministries of social service, and justice is more like political ministries.
What's the first one? What?
Diaconal. Diakonia. Diaconal, the from the Greek word for ministry, I guess, for service. We get the word English word deacon from it. Or you could say social service and social change, or advocacy, or social reform. Another pair of images would be Second Mile from the New Testament and First Mile. The allusion to Jesus' word about the Roman law in that time, which required that in an occupied country, people, the occupied people, were required under the law to carry the armor or the equipment of an occupying soldier 1 mile. And Jesus said, but I ask that you go the second mile, walk a second mile. Well, second mile talk is mercy talk, or beyond what is required. First mile talk is what is required. Or using similar biblical imagery, the one cheek or both cheeks. The one cheek would be here, the two cheeks would be here. Turn the other cheek. Or love your neighbor who loves you. That's simple human justice. That's an understanding in the justice column. Loving your enemy is in this column. That goes beyond what is expected or required. In international economic terms today, better aid to the third world belongs in this column. In this column, it would be fairer trade. We don't want more aid, we want better prices for our products and access to the markets of the rich countries. That's a part of the Justice Department. Mercy would be like food baskets or pantries in our churches. Justice, once it's established as part of the law, would be food stamps. Or I would add Social Security. People have a right to expect it. In fact, we use the word entitlement for that kind of thing. Once it's in the law, you see it as part of the justice system rather than as part of the charity system of society. Mercy, I'm not going to write anymore because I'm running out of board and I can't get down there very well. Mercy would be the late workers in the vineyard who get beyond what they had a right to expect. And predictably, it angered the other workers who worked throughout the day and said, that's not fair. And in the story, the master of the vineyard said, why isn't it fair? I paid you what I agreed to. You got the going wage for a day. Isn't it my business if I choose to give these others who worked only a couple hours the same wage? Well, no, it isn't. It was fair enough until you decide to do that. And once you decide to do that, relative to what you paid them, it's not fair. So the early workers in the vineyard, justice. The late workers in the vineyard, mercy. Or again, what the prodigal son receives is mercy. What the elder son wants the prodigal to receive is justice. And finally, you can use the image of water. The cup of cold water is described biblically as an example of mercy to those who are thirsty and in need. And I think in the water imagery, the justice category would say the rushing stream, which sweeps everything before it. Let justice roll down like a mighty stream. Well, you can fill out endlessly that contrast, that comparison, by yourself. But those are some clues. Now let me move to some comments on the way biblical justice and the American or Western European understanding of justice interact. They are not identical, though the Western understanding of justice has been influenced quite a bit by the biblical understanding. But I think it doesn't go as far as the biblical. Ethicists and political scientists have argued for thousands of years about justice and the definitions of justice. One of the old sayings puts it this way. Question: when will there be justice in Athens? Answer: there will be justice in Athens when those who are not injured are just as outraged as those who are. That's when there will be justice in Athens. You could say that about our society as well. A contemporary version of the same point is used by John Rawls, R-A-W-L-S, in his A Theory of Justice. Rawls reasons that the way to envision a just society, if you want to imagine what a just society would really be like, is for a people, any people, we could do it here as a group, to design the kind of society they would want to live in if they did not, if each of us did not know the station that each of us would occupy. That is, you would not know ahead of time if you would be male or female in this envisioned society. You wouldn't know your race. You wouldn't know if you would be middle-aged, a child, an older person. You wouldn't know your ability level. You wouldn't know anything about yourself except that you would be in that society. And his thesis is that if I were ignorant of who or what I might be in a society, I would want to shape it in such a way that it would meet my needs, that it would be fair to me. I would want to construct it in a way that I would be assured of being sustained in it, not having the chance to get very rich, simply sustained. That's an appeal to self-interest. I would want, in fact, we all do want, the kind of society in which our needs will be met. Rawls concedes that that's an appeal to self-interest. I happen to think that that, at least to a fairly large degree, is biblically supportable. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. If I would be among the least of those in a society, however that's defined, among the most marginal, the most marginated, the most vulnerable, and that society would meet my needs, then presumably it would meet the needs of all of my neighbors as well. We are to want for our neighbor, therefore, that which we desire for ourselves. Not in any sick, self-centered way, selfish way, but in a normal human way. But the biblical idea of justice goes a lot farther than that. Dan McGuire, who teaches ethics at Marquette, has compared biblical justice with the American secular understanding of justice in a set of contrasts to make this point. And this is borrowing from McGuire. He says American justice owes a lot to ancient Greece, to Plato and Aristotle. It owes something also to the biblical tradition, which has influenced Western thought. But biblical justice reflects much more completely the prophetic tradition and Jesus our Lord. Well, here are four comparisons that McGuire makes. American justice seeks to be impartial, treating everybody in the same circumstances the same. Biblical justice, however, is unashamedly partial. It is biased. It's biased toward the poor, the vulnerable, the marginal, the left out, the alien, the stranger, widows and orphans, people with certain special needs because of disabilities. And biblical justice argues that they deserve that tilt, not because they're better people in a moral sense, but simply because of their vulnerability. It's a kind of divine affirmative action plan, I think, in which you're evening up the imbalances that exist in normal human demographics. Second comparison, American justice is blindfolded and imbalanced. Typical symbol is what? The blindfolded lady holding the scales to show that it's not partial, I guess, to the privileged or to whoever. It is therefore a kind of static concept. But biblical justice says, take off the blinders and see who's messing with the scale. See whose thumb is on that scale. Biblical justice, again, is not static, but it's like a rushing stream. It's dynamic. It's moving. Third contrast. American justice is reactive. It reacts to instances of injustice. And at least in our legal system, you have to bring the case to the system and present it and say, now, is not this an example of injustice and ought it not be righted? Biblical justice, on the other hand, is proactive. It commands us to seek out those who are weak, hungry, poor, imprisoned, and to practice justice toward them. Fourth, American justice is based on rights and merits. But in biblical justice, needs outrank any merit system. The poor may not be entitled to anything in American justice. But in biblical justice, they deserve economic resources purely for reasons of being poor, on the basis of need. There shall be no poor among you, the people of Israel are told as they enter the land of promise. Now, I would argue that a lot of our continuing debate, our public debate in this society about what is just and right, is a dialogue between these two understandings of justice. And I think particularly when a biblical people enter that dialogue, we are bringing with us, consciously or unconsciously, some of our biblical heritage and trying to use that to shape or reshape our common American understandings of what is just and what is right. And because all of us are a mixture of both Athens and Jerusalem, both Plato and the prophets, we struggle to combine the two in our quest for a just society. And I would argue that the current debate over federal budget priorities can be looked at appropriately through that lens, just as the debate about immigration policy these days can be looked at through that lens, and any number of other issues. Well, some concluding words on the two modes of neighbor love, and then we can enter a discussion about this. A society without a high priority on justice is undependable. However you define justice, however that society defines it, and I'm speaking here purely in human terms, those most vulnerable are especially bereft of what they need if there is not a high priority on justice in that society. Without the promise of income security for retirement years, older people in our society, in what is essentially a cash economy, would be dependent on voluntary sharing by the rest of us. That's basically the way it used to be. It isn't anymore, at least for a majority of us. It would not be much economic security in a modern, anonymous industrial society to depend on the voluntary charity of the rest of us. I do not think I would want to depend on it. I wouldn't want my parents to have to depend on it. Once that kind of economic provision for retirement years is written into law, it has become part of the justice arrangement of our society. And then we can say that we are no longer at the mercy of well-intentioned people who may or may not take care of us. Note the language that we use. We say, I am no longer at your mercy, meaning at your whim, your willingness to continue to be merciful toward me. That's one point. A society needs a high priority on justice. At the same time, a society without a high priority on mercy or compassion or going beyond what justice requires will be coldly systematic, lacking in human feel and human touch. Without people who will go beyond the simple requirements of law, there would be much emptiness in our common life. That's why even criminal justice needs a measure of mercy. And we want that, I think, for our criminal justice system. It needs the possibility of pardons, of commutation of sentence, of amnesty, which is legal forgetfulness. Justice needs mercy to make it humane. And that's why we're able to say, I throw myself on the mercy of this court. Justice is more than mercy in human relations because justice can never be demanded or required. Because justice can be demanded or required. Once it's part of the covenant of that society, what will be expectable, you can expect it. Doesn't mean you'll always get it, but you can press your claim. You can say, I am entitled. Mercy, by definition, is undeserved, and that can never be compelled. It is not an entitlement. As soon as I can say to you, you owe me mercy, or you owe me charity, I'm entitled to your goodwill toward me, to your grace, it has ceased being grace. It has ceased being charity. I cannot require you to be charitable toward me or merciful toward me or the very character of charity itself is changed. Thus, if I am in poverty in America, I would rather have the support of law or justice to let me survive than to depend on your charity toward me. Because your charity can change quickly. And it must be so, or it isn't true charity. You can change your mind, or it isn't genuine charity. You cannot be compelled, or it isn't genuine charity. You can lose interest. You can decide that I'm undeserving of your charitable impulse. It has to be that way, or it would cease to be charity. And because that's so, justice, in one sense, is more than mercy. But in the same breath, we need to add that mercy is more than justice. It is more than justice because mercy can go beyond the merely deserved or required. Look again at the prodigal son, or the parable of the late workers in the vineyard, which I take it are supreme stories about grace. Mercy turns the other cheek. Mercy walks the second mile. Justice stops with one cheek and one mile. Well, we need more than justice from God, as we've said earlier. We also need more than justice from our neighbors, from our parents, from our children, from our spouses, from our fellow citizens. That is, we all need grace from each other all the time. Or, in some sense, we die. So we need both justice and mercy for wholeness. The world needs both. Human societies need both. Our neighbors need both. God gives us the perfect example of both. And we're called to follow that example. Well, we've spoken of justice and mercy as if they were cleanly separable, and I don't really think they are, except in the abstraction that we're doing here. Sometimes it's not so easy to separate them. There's a classic discussion of charity by Maimonides, the 12th century Jewish philosopher, which I rather like and which I'd like to conclude with. Maimonides says, charity or mercy can be understood in progressively more profound ways, progressively deeper ways, until the final stage of charity is close to a definition of justice. And this is the way he outlines the eight levels, or eight degrees, eight stages of charity. And if you want, I can put these on the board later. You can copy them down from there if you don't get them the first time through. He says, the first stage of charity is giving to the poor, but with bad grace. Again, note the language. To be gracious, but with bad grace. Begrudgingly. That is charity, but it's the most superficial level. Second level, giving with good grace, but not giving enough. Third stage, giving enough, but only after being asked. Four, giving without being asked. Five, giving without knowing who will benefit from the gift. I've been struck time and again in working with the hunger appeal of our church how much all of us would like to follow our gift all the way to the recipient and know exactly who gets it, in what village, in what part of India, and even the great appeal of advertising for giving by adopted children, adopted child approaches. That's very appealing. We like to personalize, and that's not necessarily bad. We like to follow our gift so that it isn't at the other end anonymous. So Maimonides says the fifth level or stage is giving without knowing who will benefit from the gift. The sixth stage is giving without the beneficiary knowing who is the giver. That is, without the recipient knowing who is the giver. Seven, giving without knowing the beneficiary and without the beneficiary knowing the giver. Both ways, anonymity. Just because we are told there's a need. And then the eighth level is giving the poor the means to escape from their poverty, which moves you over into systemic change. Giving the poor the means to escape from their poverty. Well, both God and human beings practice both mercy and justice. In a sense, we both fail. God, because human beings frustrate God's intention to work perfect mercy and perfect justice in our lives. We fail also to practice mercy and justice completely in purely human terms. That's obvious because of sin. And yet, because of God's revelation of himself, we have a picture of perfect mercy and perfect justice. The church's task, I think, is to call us back again and again to that divine expression of mercy and justice, and to seek to live in the world as a kind of advance party for the new age, when both mercy and justice will be complete. Our calling, therefore, is to point to the connections in our public life and to call a society to recognize the need for both. In our public life, not just in our faith community, in our religious associations, but in our public life, we need both mercy and justice. A human system of any kind needs both. And it seems to me that the biblical people are called uniquely to lift up that need. Okay, we have about 20 minutes left to discuss this, and we can take it anywhere you want to go with it. If you want to take issue with any of what I've laid out, feel free to do that. If you want to make a comment, you don't just have to ask questions.
Do we fill in any blanks now, or do you want to do that later?
Say some more.
Number 3 and 4 in this eight stages, eight steps.
Oh, the Maimonides stages?
Yeah.
Giving, 3 is giving enough, but only after being asked. And 4 is giving without being asked.
In the, you know, you have mercy and justice here. Are you talking about justice? I came a little late. Justice as defined by our society and mercy?
Basically, the biblical understanding of justice as that, well, in all...
On the board here.
Yeah, that's essentially the biblical understanding too, I think. Any use of the word justice means what is fair, what you can expect, what is demanded, what is required. Whether it's what God has a right to expect of us, which we do not meet, I said, we do not fulfill, and therefore we don't receive justice from God, we receive mercy. Because if God gave us justice, what we justly deserved, we would die. So however you define justice, I think the bottom line for justice is what can be expected.
So it seems to me that God can expect us to go the second mile, mm-hmm, and to turn the other cheek. And that's not just a matter of mercy for us, but it's a matter of justice, Christian justice.
Well, that's why I say when you press them, they tend to blur into each other. I think for the biblical people, especially, they blur together. And yet I think you can talk about them separately in the sense that when we are declared just, what we call justification, we say that's of grace. That is not what we deserve. And when we relate to other people according to that same mode, at least in human terms, that's beyond what can be required of us. And that's therefore the mercy or charity call. See, I'd like to redeem the word charity and keep it as a good word for what it really is, at the same time admitting that charity is not sufficient in a human order.
That would be upstairs. That would be my point of wondering if justice is really the first step and charity or mercy being the second step. That I thought it's been misused to think that mercy has been relegated to a lower level, if you want to get into, mm-hmm, hierarchical language. It is the second mile.
That's
what
right.
is required is the justice. You do it. That's not argue about it. Too often we're into charity, so we don't have to do justice.
Yeah.
But in actuality, the charity or mercy is much more radical than doing justice for what some of the things you laid out, I thought.
It is.
That's what I'm confused about.
Well, it is. That's why I said each is more than the other. Justice is more than charity because you can never demand charity as an entitlement, or it is no longer charity. And charity is more than justice. Mercy is more than justice because it goes the second mile. It turns the other cheek. It loves enemy as well as those who treat me as friend. So I think both and are true. That's the paradox. Mercy is more than justice. That's a true statement. And justice is more than mercy is also a true statement.
Would compassion be a better word?
Maybe.
I mean, to help redeem, I mean, that's the in word nowadays.
Maybe. I would fall back again on the argument that if I were poor in America, I would like to have, just out of my own self-interest, certain entitlements. That the society will take care of me if I cannot take care of myself and my parents, you know, and I now expect that because that's part of the entitlements, that they will have Social Security income, even though they have already used up all that they paid in plus interest. They're now using the benefits that my generation of employees pays into the system. And that's all right. That's part of the contract we've written with one another. But I don't think they like it if I would call that charity. That's part of the justice arrangement now. And yet, they would not, I think, want to fall back on an earlier time when we, in our present anonymous industrial society, where we took care of each other in old age through the family or however.
Is that justice on a world market or on a world level, or is that clouding what?
I don't think we have anything approaching justice in economic terms on a global level. We struggle even to approach it within our own domestic society, and it's difficult. And, you know, some things that were written into the, or have been written into the entitlement agenda are now being withdrawn again. And we get politicians, and I'm not sure about the right or wrong of this. I think it would be good to debate it a little bit here. We get politicians saying that this should no longer be an entitlement. This ought to be thrown back on the churches to take care of, or whoever. You know, it was said early in the present administration that if every church in America took on 8 poor families, we wouldn't need welfare. That kind of argument is saying, let's go back to charity as the way of doing this.
But that becomes a forced kind of a system then, doesn't it?
Yeah,
then it ceases to become charity.
That's right, and if it doesn't cease to be charity, it's going to be undependable because the charitable one can change his or her mind.
So really then what the government is advocating is a shift in justice.
Yeah, a redefinition. Yeah.
Okay. I think that a lot of times when we hear cries or we cry, it isn't fair. What we're really saying is you've changed the rules on me. We are not looking at whether or not it is really just. If you change the rules, mm-hmm. and you were mm-hmm. formerly entitled, just like you say, and you change it so I'm no longer entitled.
Yeah.
I say that's not fair.
Right. Yeah.
But that's a static justice, not the biblical or the dynamic justice really looks at
need
more. That's right, looks at need
looks
rather
at need.
Than
mm-hmm.
what the law is.
Yeah. Yep.
Isn't mercy a whimsical thing in a sense that it often depends on the attitude and the space that the giver is at? It really makes it uncertain for the people who are at the receiving end to be dependent on somebody else's willingness.
Exactly. That's both its glory and its risk for the one who depends on it. That is, you cannot depend on it because the charitable one may turn to a different charity or a different object of charity next year. And as soon as you require it, like through tax system, then it's part of the what I would call the justice arrangement.
We're talking about such essential things like food, healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, you can't give it up like a month or two.
Which I think is why most modern industrial societies have put that into the justice category. You have a right to expect that, and have left to charity, United Way things, other less survival related needs.
I guess my problem is that it's not. When I'm not merciful, when I'm not gracious, is that that comes from lack of understanding of what my mercy is doing, what my graciousness is doing. Wouldn't it be helpful to maybe see mercy and its greater good, the impact that it's going to do, or the justice that it's going to create in the long run, or the impact of it for, you know, on greater good. What are some of the things that you can do to realize that? What are some of the things that you can do to keep that in mind whenever you advocate graciousness and mercy?
Well, I think in the church's proclamation, we can work harder than we have to stress the elements of community, that we all need each other, depend on each other, live from each other, on behalf of each other, at the expense of each other. Because of human sin, I don't know if we'd ever get to the state where we didn't need justice arrangements, because we'd all take care of each other's needs through charity. I don't know if we'd ever get there, but I think we could do a better job. Some societies seem to have a better sense than our individualistic Western societies do of the community's needs. And I think the more societies are intimate and less anonymous, the more we know each other, the more likely it is to happen. I've been struck by the fact that we pray regularly for when we sit down to meal, we thank God for our food. But our prayers hardly ever thank the people who got the food to our table, the farmers, the people who processed it, the people who prepared it. We forget to thank them, but we're also dependent on them for life. And in the horizontal level, those within human community who take care of our needs, and vice versa. We don't have a very strong sense in American culture of the whole community's oneness and interdependence, I think.
I think it would be very just if every person here would sign for themselves.
Would what?
It would be just if you all signed for yourself.
Very good. Everyone who spoke would have to sign.
Huh? I didn't do it.
That's a good illustration. Back there. You could also, I think the Bible also includes typically in that list the alien, the one who is without citizenship rights in the society, but is in the midst, the stranger and sojourner. And of course that's an issue in contemporary American public life too. Yeah.
I'd like to take off a bit what my friend over in the corner, whose name I don't know, said. I hear her saying then that whether we are dispensing justice or mercy depends upon who has power.
Mm-hmm.
And people without power tend not to get as much justice.
Mm-hmm. And in its demonic form, we want them to be dependent on our mercy, our charity, because that's a way of controlling them and keeping them in their place. And I think it's precisely because charity can be turned off. And they know it, and we who dispense it know it. And look at how we distribute our foreign aid as a country. In a sense, it's charity. That is, we're not required to do it. It's very clear that we give it to our friends and withhold it from those who are not our friends. And we use it as a foreign policy tool. I'm not suggesting that that is somehow wrong or should be changed. I think that's the way governments behave. We just happen to be able to do it on a larger scale because we're a bigger power and have more development aid to distribute. But we do it. Most of our development aid in the last decade has gone to two countries, Egypt and Israel. They are not necessarily the two neediest countries, per capita or any otherwise. But we do it for foreign policy reasons. And it is also clear that we can turn it off whenever we choose and divert it.
If you're elsewhere. Not suggesting that that is wrong, are you suggesting that it's right?
I don't like it. I wish it were otherwise. I wish we would divorce our development assistance through my tax dollars and yours from considerations of foreign policy, that is our military security interests in the world. But I'm not sure that I expect it to change, because I think that's the way governments behave. They always behave in what they understand to be the self-interest of the country first, including in their charity. That's how they behave. Jimmy Carter tried to make some movement toward doing aid in terms of human rights violations or the lack of violations. And it was very, very difficult to get it through Congress, and we've pretty much turned away from it again. But I think the witness of Christians in that debate ought to be to hold up that goal. But I think we shouldn't be too surprised if we're always going to compromise on it, too, because of the nature of the political process. Yeah?
One thing that's challenging me right now, I guess it's the, well, I know what it is, it's the definition of mercy. You're speaking here of our foreign aid policy as being mercy, but are we doing it because we want to or because we feel we have to? That's where my definition challenge comes. Why is it just from the heart because we want to do it, because we want to have to do it?
Well, I think in terms of our own national self-interest, we feel we have to do it, and that's why we grudgingly do as little as
as
we do.
And that's a justice-type deal.
But from the recipient's perspective, I don't think it's justice in the sense that they can expect it. It depends on their behavior and our attitude toward them, whether or not they can continue to get it.
So this whole discussion kind of comes down to then, in my mind, whether how you're going to define justice, how you're going to define mercy in your own mind is how you take this whole discussion in.
Yeah, and I think a useful alternative terminology for most of this would be deserved and undeserved, or law and grace, law and gospel. Use that too, I think. You had a comment.
Well, I just relative to whether our foreign trade is mercy or not. That can be taken back to the eight stages. You know, if it were true, unconditional gift, unconditional grace, you know, it'd be down there at seven or eight. But it is still mercy, even if it's up in here one or two. The other thing I think is that having to do with mercy, you look at those things. And a lot of what mercy has to do with, something I've been struggling a lot with, looking at Paul's teaching, what mercy talks about is releasing control. Totally and completely releasing control, and the whole issue of pride, and just being willing to be dependent on God and on others, and also having the freedom to do that for other people.
That's a definition of grace, that grace is relinquishing control over another by giving the other what is not, what cannot be claimed to be deserved, and all of the, you know, all of the risk that goes with that. I think the parables are interesting in that, the two we've talked about in that regard, because grace always makes somebody else offended. Grace is offensive, and I think there's a sense in which grace is also offensive to the recipient of grace, who understands that it is precisely not what is deserved or merited or earned. And so you sometimes hear people say, well, I just want what I deserve. I just want God to give me what I deserve, or with other people. And I would argue that if we got it either from God or from other people, we'd all be sorry. We got what we deserve. So we had better say, give me grace. Did I see another hand up? Yes.
Some years ago, I took a course by a newspaper. Maybe some people here have taken the same course that was put out by the Spokane Chronicle. Or was it the Review? I forget. Anyway, they predicted that in time, the gap between the poor, rich and the poor was going to widen greatly in this country. And that the standard of living would taper off. And that the wealth would be the inherited wealth. Now, what kind of a position are we going to take on that as a church? Because that's making justice and mercy two things wide apart again.
Well, say some more about that. How do you see that as the consequence?
Well, to me, it's just a pattern in history that perhaps if we look at Europe, for instance, they've gone through these cycles. And the church has to, in my eyes, has to be active to compensate for that. And the poor lose security, and when they don't have entitlements, then we're going to have to try to compensate for that.
Well, historically, I suppose the way that's happened most often is that the land aggregates into the hands of fewer and fewer people, and that becomes the source of wealth in agrarian society particularly. And then people who did not do anything to create wealth, simply inherit it, because they are in the families that have the land, and everybody else is left landless and without support. Is that the kind of thing you're thinking of?
Well, that's what they explained, yes.
Yeah.
Not only landless, but also money, power.
I think one of the biblical visions of justice is the idea of Jubilee, which we haven't touched on. But it seems to me that that concept is a good one in that it says, left to their own devices, human beings, human societies will always concentrate wealth into fewer and fewer hands. And the way to address that is to make a fresh start periodically. Whether we consider it fair or not to redivide the land every 50 years, dividing it up by giving it back to the original, the heirs of the original owners. That kind of approach, or making a fresh start with debts, or making a fresh start with prison sentences, or whatever. Scholars argue about whether that was ever practiced in biblical times. Perhaps it wasn't. But the concept was there, of making a fresh start periodically as a way of restoring some equity, some poise, some harmony in the society. Because what you see in El Salvador and other parts of the world where there are revolutions going on, at the heart of all of them is the sources of wealth and access to the land. And some people predict that we're on the same road in America. The land is getting in, we're creating another landed aristocracy. But anyway, I think the biblical idea of Jubilee should be looked at in terms of justice too. And we don't have many mechanisms in our society for that. Some have proposed a graduated land tax as one way to get at it, just as we have a graduated income tax. I suppose our only counterpart to Jubilee would be the tax system itself, where we do try to redistribute some of the resources by taxing from the rich and giving to the poor. But even that these days is pretty well broken down, because the very rich have a lot of ways of protecting themselves from that. Well, the bell rang. Thank you very much.
Thank you.